Welcome. Today we are going to be focusing a little bit differently on providing a bite-sized insight into damages and settlement in both the clinical negligence and personal injury settings. For those of our listeners who don't really know much about the settlement of cases, of how compensation is awarded and valued, we thought it would be really great for us to provide a little bit of an insight into that. And joining me today, and sorry, I haven't introduced myself, I'm Sharon Banger from Shoesmiths Solicitors. I work in the Clinical Negligence Department and I'm a Principal Associate. And together with me today is Kate Price-Marson, who is a Senior Associate in the Personal Injury Department. So welcome, Kate.
Hi, Sharon.
Both of us are very used to having to value cases in negotiating settlements and working on that part of the case, which actually, although our minds are very focused on the settlement, as I'm sure many of my clients appreciate, but the actual settlement and the valuation of the claim comes, certainly for clinical negligence, comes some way down the line once we've been able to actually prove the claim. But it is an element that is at the forefront of our mind as we're going through it, and certainly when we're initially having our conversations with clients, when we're taking the case on. Would you agree, Kate?
Yes, exactly, Sharon. And I think this podcast is really designed to answer a lot of those sort of frequently asked questions that are pretty universal across both of the clinical negligence and personal injury cases. So hopefully it'll give our clients a bit of a insight into how the process works and hopefully answer some of those questions for them.
Yeah. So in terms of the conversation we're having today, we're assuming that be it the medical negligence, say, for example, if it was a surgical procedure that's gone wrong, or if it's personal injury, say, a car accident, that has all been admitted and we are at a point where we know that we confidently can say that we can prove that negligence has taken place and that there is an injury and a case to answer. At that stage, we very much focus our minds on what is the valuation of the claim, and valuation in terms of what makes up damages is quite complicated. The aspects of the damages that which myself and Kate are going to take you through are general damages, the nuances of when there is a fatality case and how damages in those types of cases are valued, and special damages. So initially with general damages, I thought, Kate, if you take us through the role that a judicial guidelines, a JC guidelines, have in valuation.
Yes. So as an outline, a claimant, as you say, when we're confident that there's going to be a recovery of compensation, is entitled to recover damages for pain, suffering, and loss of immunity caused by the accident. That is sort of known as PSLA in the industry, and that is intended to compensate them for past, present, and any future physical or psychiatric symptoms. And the best starting point for assessing that PSLA or the pain and suffering is by reference to what you've just described, which is the Judicial College Guidelines. And they set out a sort of financial bracket for most common types of injuries, and most injuries will fall into there. Quite often we do use a sort of precedent reference to case law as well.
Yeah, and I think we certainly in clinical negligence are often reliant on case law, because when we look at the JC guidelines, they very often, I'm sort of sure it's the case of personal injury on occasion as well, they very often only provide the start of a story as opposed to the whole picture. And it's often really useful for us to look at comparable case law. So cases which have been not always tested in the courts, but sometimes you get cases that are published which haven't, but other solicitors will publish their results after a settlement, out of court settlement. But it all adds to provide information to us as practitioners and lawyers to see what type of valuations are placed on different types of cases. And as I said, it's the same in personal injury as it is with clinical negligence. Every case is different. The example I think myself and Kate were discussing when we were preparing for this session is that there can be a car accident, or there can be a surgery that's gone wrong. And it can even be the same type of car accident and the same type of surgery for two different clients. But if that's affected someone differently, it's the focus in valuation is on the type of injury that's been suffered, as opposed to the nature of the negligence in itself, which can be often be quite similar for any two clients. And it's that element where the legal application of knowledge is crucial. That's why often it is difficult for a client to value claims themselves, because knowing where to look for case law and knowing how to apply that is quite a specialist thing to do.
That's right, Sharon. And I think a lot of times as well, clients don't realize that how we actually value those injuries is informed in most, I think, all cases, by then obtaining the medical records for each of the claimants and then instructing specialists, independent medical experts, to report on their injuries. And that really identifies, as you say, what specific injuries that claimant has suffered, as opposed to looking at, you know, the mechanism of the accident, because every client injuries are going to be different from accident to accident. And that medical evidence really gives us a guide as to how long those symptoms are likely to go on if they haven't recovered already.
Yeah, and it's that recovery period which we also include into our valuation. And just picking up on the point of medical evidence, again, something that's crucial and in some cases the very reason we need to get expert evidence, certainly where clinical negligence is concerned, is to actually differentiate the aspects of someone's injuries which are attributable to the negligence and the aspects which perhaps are not. For example, in a clinical negligence case, if we are looking at, say, a delay in diagnosis of cancer, it's actually a quite complex type of case to value, because we can't get away from the fact that someone would have had the cancer in any event. They would have needed an element of treatment in any event. And it's the we're relying very much on our experts to let us know what proportion of that person's injuries or additional treatment is attributable to the delay, the negligence. And it's those types of cases, and I'm sure there are similar in personal injury, where the weight of the medical experts really shows its value in the valuation process.
Yeah, that's right, Sharon. And just briefly on that point, I think it's really important to recognise that a lot of the personal injury cases we deal with, those times when the client might have a pre-existing injury or pre-existing condition, which is then exacerbated or made worse by those injuries in the accident. And that doesn't mean that those pre-existing injuries would negate any compensation, but it is really important that we have specialist medical evidence to determine how those have been made worse by the injuries in the accident.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other types of cases which we wanted to have a mention of is fatal cases. Now, with when someone's passed away and a claim is pursued on their behalf, normally by a family member, formally it has to be someone who has legal standing, but that who has legal standing is probably the topic of another podcast in the future. The issue of fatal cases and what compensation is received is sometimes it's quite a difficult conversation for us to have with our clients, because I think, and you'd be forgiven for thinking that the fact that someone's passed away in itself would provide a higher tariff in terms of compensation. And us as solicitors are very much bound by the way in which we are expected to value claims. And with fatal cases, just as a broad approach, the general damages are based on the pain, suffering and loss of inanimity that the person who's passed away has suffered prior to passing away due to the negligence. And then on top of that, the law does allow for items that you would expect, such as funeral expenses. And there is also a bereavement award. Kate, if you want to just take us through what the bereavement award signifies.
Yeah, so under the Fatal Accidents Act, you can bring a claim for bereavement damages if you are the surviving wife, husband, civil partner of the deceased person, or if it was the case of a minor who passed away, who was never married or had a civil partner. After 6th of October 2020, the law did change and a claim can be made for bereavement damages if there was a cohabiting partner.
Yeah, Yeah. And so I think sometimes the surprising thing for some of my clients is that it is actually restricted in such a way. And that can be sometimes the topic of a difficult conversation if someone outside of the criteria tries to be awarded the bereavement award, because it just it usually just is impossible. And then on top of that, as I said, this is a bite-sized session, so we'll literally just go through it in a simple way. The law allows for recovery of financial and non-financial dependency. So financial would be loss of earnings, loss of pension, loss of earnings that the deceased would otherwise have provided to the family, which now isn't available. And then loss, non-financial dependency is usually regarded as services. So, for example, cooking, cleaning, managing the financial affairs of the family, that type of thing. And basically things that the deceased did for the family, which again, now someone else has to do. So there's a lot that goes into valuing these cases and gathering the information. In fatal cases, I find that the witness evidence is key in being able to have an in on how a particular person and family lived their life. And we have to have quite detailed knowledge as to the contribution that the deceased had to the family and to their setup for us to be able to establish exactly what the loss is. And then we go into the realms of special damages. And again, part of what I've just said in terms of the fatal damages and what goes up into making the valuation is essentially special damages. But Kate, do you want to take us through essentially what we refer to as special damages?
Yeah, so special damages are essentially any financial losses incurred in connection with the accident. So generally, you can sort of split them into past and future losses. So past losses is essentially anything incurred to date, and future losses is something likely to be incurred in connection with the claim. So broadly speaking, most people have a claim for loss of earnings, any particular medical expenses, travel expenses. It does vary very much from claim to claim, just like the injuries themselves. But one thing that I think is really important to cover, which is quite commonly not understood by clients, is a claim for care and assistance. It's known as gratuitous care and assistance. And that is care which is provided by a friend or family member, which is provided in connection with the accident. And because it's not provided by a professional carer, it's claimed at essentially a discounted rate from the current care rate. And that is actually recoverable as part of a claim, because if a particular claimant didn't have access to that friend or family member who could provide the care, arguably that claimant have to go and find a professional carer to provide that same care. That is why we can then go and recover it at a reduced rate.
And then the other thing I think that is really important to note in terms of our special damages schedules, that in the higher value, more complex cases where someone has been left with quite severe life-changing injury, what we also allow for in our schedules is rehabilitation costs, various therapy costs. When Kate was talking about care, we allow for gratuitous care, but if there is a need for professional care, we will also factor those in. And again, we come back to the importance of expert evidence, because if we allow for all those different types of costs, we need to obtain the expert evidence which supports it. So if, say, if a client needs physiotherapy, or if they need occupational therapy, or they need care, we need to obtain reports from a physiotherapy expert, an occupational therapy expert, and the care expert, all separate expertise, all separate individuals who provide and add information to the schedule and actually provide costing information as to what they think will be reasonable in a particular client's circumstances, and then also provide information with respect to the relevant rates and time that will be needed. But yeah, all of those things go into making a special damages schedule, and it's that plus the general damages which we discussed before, which effectively go to making the valuation for a claim and giving us a basis of evaluation. And it is very much a bite-sized overview of that aspect of it, because there's a lot more that does go into it. But that's the everything succinctly. And then myself and Kate just actually just wanted to go through very briefly the types of modes of settlement for a case, because very often when we start a case, we will be with a client who hasn't been through this process before, and it's often really interesting and useful for them to know how cases settle. Now, what I always start with is that the vast majority of cases, be it personal injury or medical negligence, they don't go to trial. There is usually an out-of-court settlement, and that's the case now more than ever, where the courts are really trying to encourage amicable settlements and to encourage the cost to be as minimum as possible in these cases. A very common way of a case settling is via the CPR rules in accordance with Part 36. So what that would be is the exchange of correspondence or sometimes verbal conversations, when one party provides to the other with an offer, and there's a negotiation of a settlement within the frame of Part 36 of the CPR. And I certainly find in clinical negligence that is quite a common way of cases settling. Is it the same in personal injury, Kate?
Yes, Sharon, it is. And I think, as you say, it's very common to have Part 36 offers exchanged. And for the purposes of this podcast, as you say, being bite-sized, it's difficult to talk fully about the extent of Part 36 offers and their implications. But what I would say is that, they do have a very complicated set of rules. And any time that Part 36 offer is received or made in one of our cases, we do give our clients very specific advice about that offer, the implications and what it would mean in respect of their own specific case. So it's hard to go into too much detail for the purposes of this podcast.
There is likely to be future episodes that focus on this, but yeah, that's it succinctly. And then the other forms of assessment which aren't trial involve mediation and roundtable settlements. And I'll take both of them in one go. Now, mediation from a clinical negligence perspective generally happens at a point where both parties agree that there is potential for the issues to be narrowed. Now, I don't actually just focus on settlement in terms of financial settlement here, because sometimes mediation can occur to narrow issues with respect to liability, to talk about negligence. What I'm finding, certainly through the course of my career, that there was a point where mediation wasn't even a thing in clinical negligence in terms of it being a mode of settlement. And now it is, and it's becoming more and more popular. In a mediation, you generally have a mediator there, someone who's appointed to act as an intermediary between the parties, and they will discuss whether it's liability or offers. They'll provide a mode of mediating between the parties about those issues, and very often it can lead to settlement, or it can at least lead to narrowing down the settlement brackets or the issues as it is. Is it the same in personal injury, Kate?
Yes, Sharon. Yes, exactly that. I mean, normally when we get to the stage of a mediation, there is some intent to look to settle either the entirety of the case or an issue in the case. So hopefully both parties' minds are focused. But certainly, as you say, it's no guarantee. This independent intermediary certainly does help to try and focus the minds, as to settling a particular issue, if that's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And then with a roundtable meeting, RTM, or you might hear it referred to as a JSM, a joint settlement meeting, that actually involves both parties arriving with their solicitors. The clients should be there, and barristers. And I mean, traditionally, these would all be in person. I think we're going back to that a little bit more now, but during and post COVID, we were doing these all through the wonder that is technology on Teams. And generally, each party is in a separate room, and then you have one room where you come to meet. And again, you narrow down the issues. Again, roundtable meetings, the focus, I think, against mediation is more on settlement with roundtable meetings, financial settlement. But again, there is no guarantee, there's no onus on either party to definitely settle a case. At the very least, what you do find, if there hasn't been a settlement, there'll be a narrowing down of settlement brackets, and there'll be a better understanding for both parties as to where each side is at in terms of what they're including in the valuation and why they perhaps aren't agreeing with the other side's valuation, if that indeed is the case. I tend to find that roundtable meetings happen more on the higher values and complex cases, basically because it's quite an expensive process to undergo. You've got solicitors and barristers in the room, all of whom obviously are charging for their services. And it's quite often these meetings can last the best part of a day if you're going back and forth. So, and on that point, it is quite an onerous task for the client as well to have to sit there and almost justify the valuation that has been placed upon their case in circumstances where it often is that something has had quite a life-changing and emotional impact on a client. So I personally think it's a really good way of settling cases, but it is quite an onerous thing for a client to do. Would you agree, Kate?
Yes, Sharon, I do. And I think there's so much preparation, as you alluded to go into these roundtable meetings. It's almost, in essence, preparing for, not quite as advanced as preparing for trial, but it is quite a lot of work. So I think for the clients, it's understandably, quite a big day, and it is helpful, to be able to give them a bit of an indication of what they can expect in that sort of setting. It's not usually the case that they will meet with the other side, the defendant or the defendant's solicitors, although in some rare cases that has happened. But generally speaking, it is, the barrister or the solicitors who will be going back and forth with the other side, speaking to them, making negotiations if that is the case, and ultimately then bringing that information back to the clients.
Yeah, and it's worth saying with roundtable meetings, they can, in theory, they can happen at any stage, but certainly from clinical negligence cases, they tend to happen once both sides have had a chance to at least do their initial investigations into the valuation. So have all their expert evidence in place, have a schedule of loss, have their valuation complete. So they're going in with complete figures, with supported figures. Certainly from a claimant's perspective, I would be very hesitant to agree to go into a meeting unless we had all of that complete, because it gives the client the confidence that we've completed our investigations. We're in a quite strong position to negotiate, because essentially what a roundtable meeting is a form of negotiation, to negotiate with the defendants. And if there is a settlement, that will be a good settlement for our client.
And I think the other thing to note is that simply because a mediation or a roundtable meeting doesn't lead ultimately to the settlement of a claim, that isn't necessarily a negative thing. It just means that we weren't able to agree a successful resolution at that meeting or the mediation, and that doesn't necessarily prevent us from, then proceeding to trial.
Yeah, I mean, they could proceed to trial, but I've had so many situations where perhaps on the day, perhaps because the defendants were trying to play hardball or otherwise, there hasn't been a settlement, but within a week or two there has, because we've had the opportunity to put our case to the defendants and something may have resonated, or they may have had the chance to think about things in a different light after the meeting. So I completely see it as a catalyst sometimes to providing a settlement within a reasonable period of time. So you quite rightly mentioned the final form, which I don't even think we'd refer to it as a settlement. It is the trial. It's a funny thing, because actually from the point of taking a case on, we are preparing the case for a trial. Certainly once court proceedings have been issued, there's a timetable in place and the focus very much is the trial, preparing the case for the trial, having the medical evidence ready, having the figures ready, having everything supported, and making sure that both sides' experts have spoken to each other to make sure that they have narrowed down the issues for a trial. As I said before, very few cases go to trial. The ones that do for varying reasons. mainly, I'm putting it very simply, is that the parties can't come to an agreement either with respect to negligence or liability or with respect to the valuation of the claim. A case will go to trial if there's a point of contention between the parties. What that will involve, very succinctly, is that if there's expert evidence, that will be tested at trial. All of the parties will have a chance to hear the evidence from each party. There will be a discussion through the figures and what's made up of the valuation. And ultimately, it will be for the judge to decide as to the outcome. And as I said, it's difficult for me to go into the outcome because the outcome is dependent on what the trial is there for. But say if it is for deciphering whether one of the parties, whether the defendant is negligent or not, then that's the finding that we'll be looking for. But yeah, and if it is that they're found to be negligent, then obviously what follows from that is a financial settlement. And because of all the preparation that takes place by the representative for the claimant in a trial setting, you'll almost certainly know the ballpark figures as to what the settlement amount will be. Even if that trial is to do with the quantification of the claim, you'll know roughly how much it will be because of the preparation that takes place before a trial. And the preparation for a trial, I know, Kate, you've had one recently, is mammoth. There's so much work that needs to be done to ensure that that case is ready.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, as we've said throughout this podcast, each case is totally different. You might have a trial whereby liability is the key issue, or it might be quantum, the actual value of the claim. And each case, you know, as you say, when you're preparing for it, the focus on each of those elements will be different. And that will be very much determined by witnesses, how many witnesses you have, the extent of the medical evidence that you have, whatever the specific issues are in each case. And again, you know, we would take every client through what the expected process is likely to be for trial in their own specific case. But I think, you know, just touching on trials, it's really a very common question that I'm sure you get as well, Sharon, which is from the outset of a claim, how long will it take us to get to trial? And I think that's just, unfortunately, an impossible question to answer. Again, it's just so case specific, but it certainly is not a quick process. And, you know, all these potential avenues for settlement that we've mentioned normally do take place before a trial. It's certainly not a case where we get medical evidence and immediately go to trial. There's a lot of steps which take place before then to try and attempt to settle the claim.
I was going to say, I think that's very much founded in the principles of the CPR and the courts generally encouraging parties to have an amicable settlement, to have an out-of-court settlement, to ensure that those settlements take place a little bit earlier than they otherwise would in the trial setting, and also to reduce and limit costs of investigation and of the claims as a whole. But I think, I hope for the listeners, for those of you who are still listening out there, this has been an interesting overview of damages and settlement. We at Shoesmiths have a lot of experience in dealing with this type of exercise on our cases. We've got practitioners who have been doing the job for tens of years. And so when we look at our settlements, we're reliant on JC guidelines, we're reliant on case law, but we also have the experience in-house to know what different types of injuries should be valued at. So we hope this has provided a useful insight as to how we value claims and how claims generally are settled or how they resolve in a trial setting. Thank you for listening.